Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in our studio Bonnie Stannard. Bonnie, who grew up in rural South Carolina, moved away after college and married Douglas Stannard of LaSalle, Illinois. Before her husband's retirement, her family lived in Chicago, Brussels, and that's Brussels, Belgium, not Brussels in the United States, Atlanta, and Richmond. She has edited several regional publications, and her poetry has appeared in literary journals such as Harper Palette, Slipstream, and The Griffin. Upon retirement, she and her husband moved to South Carolina, where they currently reside in Lexington. She has published 4 antebellum novels and 2 historical fiction novels, and has also published a children's picture book. She is a member of the Columbia 2 chapter of the South Carolina Writers Association. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, talking about your latest book, which is What Missing Means, but before we get to that, tell us a little bit about your background and your writing experience.
I was born in Lexington County. I'm a Rawls originally before I married a Stannard. And my father was from the family of what was called the River Rawls. And they were called the River Rawls because the family grew up and stayed around the North Edisto River. And in fact, that's where I grew up. And my father was a farmer and my mother worked in a factory in Wagner, South Carolina. It made things like shirts and bathrobes, that sort of thing. And I graduated Pillion High School, went to the University of South Carolina, married and moved out of South Carolina, and have just come back in the last 15, 20 years.
So you have deep roots in South Carolina.
Yes, indeed, right.
Well, what got you interested in writing? And tell us about maybe your educational background that maybe got you into writing.
Well, I can't say that I got interested in writing early. Mm. I came to writing late and reading. In fact, I didn't appreciate reading, I guess, until I got out of college. When I was in a high school, if you liked school or if you liked reading or that sort of thing, you were a sissy. Mm. So I did things like climb trees and play baseball and wrestle with my brothers and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do a lot of reading to begin with. And in college, I was, it was 4 years of hysterical nervousness for me. The pressure was on, I had to read. And so of course when you have to read, it becomes something, a chore, a task. And so I didn't realize that reading could be something you could enjoy.
Exactly.
And so it was well after I was out of college that I appreciated reading and that I started looking toward writing. And it wasn't maybe, I always liked to write. In fact, my high school English teacher, Mrs. Louise Robinson, used to require themes from time to time. Mm-hmm. And I still remember writing those with enthusiasm.
I remember when they called them themes. Remember?
Yes.
You know, now they're called essays or something.
Yes, right. And I became the editor of the high school newspaper, which was the Sensber, and I enjoyed that a great deal. But I didn't realize that this was something I really wanted to do until, well, I married, and then after I married, I had 3 kids in 4 years. So that in that time period, I was focused on my family and my children and seeing that they got off to a good start. And once they got into school, I started having more free time, and I think it was then that I became more interested in writing. Mm-hmm. And when we were in Chicago, I had the good fortune of going to the New Trier Extension, which is a writer's workshop, a poetry workshop, and I met Eloise Fink there. And Eloise was a terrific inspiration to me. She believed in me. She believed in my writing. Mm. And I discovered in the workshop that my writing, my poetry, had the respect of my peers. So that in itself was an encouragement to get into poetry. But then we moved to Brussels, Belgium, and I diverted from poetry more to prose because I began submitting articles to an English language newspaper there. It was a It was a monthly newspaper called The Rendezvous. The English American presence in Brussels then was greater than it is now.
What years were we talking about?
Oh, in the 1980s.
Okay.
And I eventually became the editor of The Rendezvous. And I discovered that I also liked editing. I enjoyed working with writers and producing something that you could look at and say, you know, this is something I've produced, and mm-hmm. I'm very proud of it. And when we came back to the States, I kind of got away from prose. It was more reporting. I started a newspaper in Lexington County and went into Aiken County and up to Ridge Spring. It came out once a month, and it was called the Fairview News. And I not only produced the text for that, but I also did the typesetting, computer generated files. And just it was had about a
so you did everything basically.
I did everything for that one. Well, I did have some reporters who reported on the news, but this was distributed for maybe 2,000 people, and this is still in the 80s when I was mm-hmm. In the 90s when we came back to the States mm-hmm. and we moved to Atlanta. So I've always been it's kind of been incremental. Mm-hmm. You know, I started out with the workshop, and then I became engaged and work with published journals and mm-hmm. this. But then once we moved to Richmond, and then I started thinking more. I had more free time, and I began to think more about getting my writing, addressing my writing more seriously. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it was then when I took my writing seriously. Mm-hmm.
What do you think brought the change from poetry to journalism to novels? Because they're all very different.
Yes, they are. It's like apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different ball game. When your poetry is, I see poetry as an exercise class for language. Mm. In other words, you're exploring how we communicate with language. And of course, language has many limitations. Our words, we don't realize it, but I never realized it much, but that our words actually can control our thoughts. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have thoughts that go outside of the range of words. Mm-hmm. And so this is where poetry comes in. It tries to expand our experience with language. And then, of course, practically the opposite of that is reporting.
Stating the facts.
Yeah. Yes, the articles you read in the newspaper. Nobody wants to see expansion of language there. You want something concrete. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to understand exactly what is there. And then fiction is perhaps in between those two. It's mm-hmm. Fiction is, I think, more of leading the reader into experiences that they haven't had, exploring mm-hmm. experiences you haven't had, mm-hmm. and exploring possibilities, perhaps.
So I had mentioned What Missing Means, and that's the title of your latest book. And in fact, you were here February 22nd, 2018, for our Speaker at the Center program, which features local authors. And tell us a little bit about your book, What Missing Means. What is it about?
What Missing Means is takes place in 1945. It's a farm family in the Midlands of South Carolina. And it's told through the eyes of Lily, who is 12 and going on 13 years old. But it's not just the story of Lily, it's the story of her family. She lives in an extended family with her grandfather, her grandmother, an aunt, and two uncles, and her mother and herself are all in one house. So we touch on all of these stories.
And I noticed in the beginning you have a genealogical chart, which
yes,
is very
to keep
helpful.
The characters.
You know, I wish every fiction novel had a genealogy chart if there's a big family.
Yes, that's to help track the characters in the story. It started out, though, What Missing Means is a sequel to Dust on the Bible. Hmm. And both of these came about first as short stories. And I discovered after a time and after a collection, maybe a number of four, five, six short stories, I discovered there were characters that looked very similar from one story to another story. Mm. And not only that, the setting was very similar. And once I made that discovery, I realized, really, this is perhaps one story. Mm-hmm. And I merged them all together and made them into, you know, made adjustments, made segues, cut out parts, changed the names so that the names followed through the story, and made it into one manuscript. But of course, as I did that, the word count added up.
Sure.
And I ended up with over 120,000 words, which is, of course, about that's the limit that I shoot for anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I had the decision to make about whether to go into stretch and make two novels or squeeze it all into one novel. And mm-hmm. of course, I made two novels out of it.
Mm-hmm. It can be more lucrative if it's two, because people have to buy more than just one.
Well, I hope these stand alone. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that if you read one,
okay,
you would be satisfied with one,
okay,
without having to read the other one or without feeling a need to read the next one.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I always find interesting is sometimes there's always a story behind the title. And did you originally come to this title, or did your publisher tell you to do something different?
No, making a title is a real challenge. I had several working titles for this one. For instance, it was at one time, Beyond the Barns, or I wanted the title to reflect or to give the potential buyer an idea about what the book was about.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, clue them in that this is a farm story. This takes place in before the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to come up with that title was a real challenge. It was one time Light in the Loft, because Lily sleeps in the loft. And the word loft itself is kind of a dated word. We don't hear that word. And mm-hmm. so you start getting clues about when the book takes place. And then I had one title that was called, this one was for Dust on the Bible. I once called it After the Cow Died. And I thought, who's going to? And actually, there is an important scene in the book in which the cow does die, and it has a big impression on Lily. But of course, that couldn't work. And I would like to have taken something from literature, maybe from, you know, like other, like As I Lay Dying kind of,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
title. But I searched through those. I never could find anything that quite worked. Dust on the Bible was maybe easier, because I took that from the title of a song.
Mm.
Hank Williams and Kidwell sang that song. So we're talking about a certain time period
okay.
for that.
All right.
But What Missing Means relates in, let's put it this way. There's a character in there named Archie, who's the young son, and he's drafted into the army, and he is sent to Germany to fight. And this happens maybe in the first third of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the rest of the book, Archie's letters come to the family. And so this is an occasion when the family, someone, Lily in particular, would sit down and they'll read the letter to the family. And together they're having this moment of missing Archie.
Mm-hmm.
It's someone is absent from the family and they're missing him.
Mm-hmm.
And in another way, I think the title relates to the story in that Lily lives a sequestered life, such as it is. It's kind of a remote life. She's on a farm. She has her friends at school. She has her family at farm. And at one point in the novel, her Aunt Theda takes her to see a movie. It's the first time she's ever been to a movie.
Mm.
And they go to see Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, Gone with the Wind came out in 1939, but it was so popular that it returned. It circulated
sure.
after then. So it's not unusual that they would have seen it in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
But after Lily sees this movie, she realizes that there's a whole world out there mm-hmm. beyond what she sees.
Right.
And so up until that time, she hadn't missed anything. But then after she saw that movie, it opened her eyes and she did miss something. She knew she was missing something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the title relates to the story.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask you to maybe read a little excerpt, can you tell us about your writing style and your writing process? Do you normally start with an outline, or do you just jumble it all together? How does that process work for you?
I tried an outline once. And my story wouldn't conform to my outline. So I sort of gave up on an outline. I think they work for some people. It doesn't seem to work very well for me. Mm-hmm. I end up getting the characters get into situations, and I'll think they're supposed to be going one way, and they'll go another way. Mm-hmm. So in terms of sometimes I know the end, I think I know the end, mm-hmm. and it might not actually be the end, but I'll mm-hmm. think I know the ending of a story. Mm. And many times, and I remind myself, in fact, I'm working on one right now, that I have to keep reminding myself about what the story is about, because mm-hmm. it starts going in all sorts of jerky directions. You know, one character will take over the spotlight, and there I am. What am I doing? Well, that's not the main character. Let's go back and figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. So my writing style is hit or miss. I sit down. I don't have in my mind before I sit down at the computer what mm-hmm. I'm going to write.
So it just evolves organically for you.
Yes, right.
That's great. Yeah. I think that's such a gift, because I think most people, you know, do have to have an outline and do need to know every little part. So maybe that's the poetry in you that.
Well, indeed, if you're writing a poem and you know where you're going, you're not really writing a poem. I mean,
you're really
making the, according to all of the advice you'll get from all of the poets, you're shooting yourself in the foot. That's not the way it works.
Exactly. So, would you like to maybe read an excerpt?
Okay. In both of these stories, Dust on the Bible and What Missing Means, Lily is pursuing a spiritual realization. She goes to the Baptist church with her grandfather and her aunt, Theda, and it's the what she sees in church has an impression on her, and she's trying to make up her mind about what she believes. And so this is from just a scene where she's in the kitchen with her mother doing the dishes. Lily helped Florence wash dishes after dinner. Why do people say joining the church is the difference between going to hell and going to heaven? More people talk about heaven and hell than know anything about it. Florence washed faster than Lily dried, and plates were piling up in the pan. Why didn't you join the church? Said Lily. Never had much time to go. But you could go one time and join. What's the point of joining if I don't go to church? 'Cause if you don't join, you'll go to hell instead of heaven, Lily said, not so much because she believed it, but to get her mother's opinion. I don't think the church decides who goes where. But what if it does? If you think it does, you ought to be a member. But what if I don't know? Lily, you can't know everything. Make up your mind what you think, and then do what you think's right. But Reverend Truax knows what hell's like. Then you ought to talk to Preacher Truax. I can't know about heaven. I don't know about heaven or hell. It's more than I can do to keep us enclosed.
That's really deep. That has a lot going on, just that one excerpt.
Well, maybe a lot's going on with Lily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like those kind of coming of age questions.
Yes, it has that element,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. One of the things that popped out at me is the name Theda. How did you come up with not only that name, but other names for your characters?
I knew a Theda. She was a tragic life, actually. She was the daughter of my great aunt, and so it was a family name. Mm-hmm. Theda is,
mm-hmm. And Lily. How did you?
Now Lily is no. Lily is not a name that I knew. I don't know how I came to Lily. She came to me.
She came to you. Just popped into your life.
Yes, I guess so.
That's fascinating. You also talked a little bit about your poetry. Do you have any poems that you would like to read now?
No, I don't. I find that. I'm not good with auditory reception of poetry?
But it's very different. The poetry readings are so different from, for instance, what you just read.
I need to see a poem on a page. That's the way I mm-hmm. can appreciate and mm-hmm. understand a poem. Mm-hmm. When a person is just reading it to me, you know, years and years ago, you know, literature began, you know, with the poems in the only auditory.
Mm-hmm,
I'm
mm-hmm,
talking Middle mm-hmm. Ages here.
Right, spoken word. Yeah.
Yes, and people had a greater sensibility to hearing things,
mm-hmm.
and I think now our sensibilities have changed such mm-hmm. that we are more visual in turn rather than auditory in terms of our appreciation of, say, any kind of prose or poetry.
Exactly, and hearing poetry, while, you know, if the poet is reading a poem that you're following along on the page, it's night and day.
Yes.
You know, it's so different than what maybe I would hear internally if I was just reading it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, especially today, because today we're much of the poetry is missing, say, the cadences and the rhythms and the rhyming, mm-hmm. interior and rhyme, in rhyme, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Much of it is missing from the poetry today. So maybe poetry that was written 100 years ago
mm-hmm.
would be, it could be more appreciated when in the spoken word than mm-hmm. even the poetry that's today.
Do you have any favorite poets?
Most of mine are traditional poets. Robert Frost,
mm-hmm.
you know, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening is one of my favorite poems. And in fact, there's an illustrated version of that poem, which is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to give a copy of that to all of my grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a beautiful, beautiful book.
Mm-hmm.
I also like T.S. Eliot.
Mm-hmm.
He's best known for Wasteland, but I like best of all the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And I also one of the poems that I find very amusing is Jabberwocky. And when I was a teacher, I required my seventh graders to memorize that poem.
Really?
And it was, I loved it because I loved to hear it. Uh-huh. That's when I loved to hear.
So you could just hear it over and over.
Yeah, so every kid would come up and recite Jabberwocky for me, and I was in heaven.
That's great. I love that thought process of, there's a poem that you really like, so you require your students to memorize it so you can hear it. That's wonderful. Well, since this podcast is Library Voices, talk to us a little bit about maybe either kind of your working relationship or personal experience with libraries, maybe what libraries mean to you.
The local libraries have been wonderful, and I would encourage them to do even more in terms of supporting local talent.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Richland County Public Library just hosted the Decalege. And I didn't go this year, but I have been in the past, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be exposed to local talent. Also, the Richland County Public Library did the author showcase, and
mm-hmm,
I was
mm-hmm.
invited to be part of that.
Oh, great.
And I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
The Lexington County Library is wonderful, too. It hosts the South Carolina Writers Association workshop, and so we meet there, you know, at least twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have invited me to make presentations to some of their branches, and I've talked about death and burial in the antebellum South
mm-hmm.
at two of the different branches. So that's very supportive of me because it's not just me. I have seen other writers, Lisa Wingate, Hope Clark, both of them
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
were guests that I remember seeing at Lexington's library.
In fact, Hope Clark is one of our readers for our Talking Book services. She has a great voice, and what she has done is she comes in, I think, once a week and actually records for our audiobooks for our blind and physically handicapped patrons.
There again, another good service.
Mm-hmm.
But just to mention a couple more, the Aiken Library hosted the Indie Authors Day last year,
mm-hmm.
and I hope they'll do it again. They put on a great program. They had, like, songwriters and script writers and and essay writers, author, and local mm-hmm. people from mm-hmm. the South Carolina. The Lake City Library
is Florence County.
Yeah, and it's Artfields is coming up, and mm-hmm. that library is one of the venues where they show art. And of course, this attracts artists from all across the Southeast. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the library is engaged in that, you can go in during Artfields, and you'll see, you know, the walls are covered with mm-hmm. illustrators, photographers, artists, that mm-hmm. all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the Florence Library. It's called the Dr. Bruce and Lee Foundation Library. Mm-hmm. They host the PD Author Expo. I don't know if they did it last year, but I've been a part of that as well.
So lots of opportunities
yes,
for venues.
It's been, yes, yes.
That's right. Wonderful. And you mentioned art. I was recently at the University of South Carolina Sumter Branch Library. And they have a wonderful art gallery as a completely separate room. And they had an artist there who is from Florence, South right. Carolina. And it is always a pleasure to see some of those things. So libraries are more than just books.
Indeed, they are. Yes.
What kind of projects do you have coming up? Do you have another novel in the
yes,
works?
Yes, I do. I'm working on one now. And I hope it's two-thirds of the way through, but it might be halfway through. I hope to have it finished in the next several months. It's another historical fiction novel. Mm-hmm. I've also just collected poems into a book, and I'm submitting it to literary publications in the hope of getting it published. Mm-hmm. And I also, the last book that I published was a children's picture book. It's called Cat's Fur. I have it's made from a poem. So I have another poem that I'd like to be illustrated and turned into a book. I have a wonderful illustrator, Marlena Shannon, and she did a great job of illustrating Cat's Fur. So I hope I can connect up with her and get another book published soon.
When you mentioned your children's book, how different is it from writing a novel to working on a children's book where you're working with an illustrator? It seems like there would be a lot more collaboration.
It is. But I started out with the text, and my illustrator actually was very good about picking up on the text making suggestions. For instance, it's a story about a witch that the whole story is the witch discovers she's allergic to cats. But anyway, she gave me like two or three different drafts of pictures of the witch, of what she saw as the witch. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she had a reaction to the poem. And so it was a collaborative work. Mm-hmm. She did a fantastic job, I think, of visualizing what I had written.
Mm-hmm. And the novel you said that's about two-thirds done, what's that about?
The working title is The Relic, but it's not going to be the final title.
It hasn't come to you yet.
it hasn't, but The Relic was what started the whole thinking process. And it's about a traveling troupe of actors in France in 1672.
Wow.
And this is taking a lot of research.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a number of books in my bookcase right now that I need to, you know, I write a paragraph and I run to a research. I have what did they use to eat? Sometimes I get so sidetracked by my research that I get go off on all these tangents. Mm-hmm. I discovered, for instance, that this is when Louis XIV was king of France, and I discovered that just as an offhand comment in one of the mostly I read like autobiographies mm-hmm. or letters, printed letters from people that lived at that time, that Louis XIV ate with his fingers, although forks had been invented and people had used forks at that time. Louis XIV only used his fingers in eating, and that he was always surrounded by people. He was never alone, which was almost, you know, it seems like that would be a burden. Mm-hmm. That whatever he did, and in fact, when he ate his meals, people were allowed to watch. as if you were at the zoo watching an elephant. You know, there you are. I don't think you would compare it to an elephant. But anyway, you know.
A caged animal.
yes, that sort of. But at the same time, the nuances that were so important to the nobility at that time was astounding. For instance, I was reading one occasion where Louis XIV became so upset because some noblewoman had sat in a chair that was above her position. Mm. So every person had a certain, you only sat in certain chairs because, mm-hmm. and that was based on the hierarchy of mm-hmm. the nobility.
Right.
He became so upset about it that it took his courtiers had to calm him down after the dinner was over because this one woman sat in the wrong chair. And of course he was a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. Aside from that, he was mm-hmm. a brilliant manipulator, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I just get off on these tangents sometimes.
and then some other nuance of the story will come to you.
Well, let's hope so.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been my privilege.
And thank you to our listeners. You can find Library Voices SC on Podbean, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio, or add us on your favorite podcast app. Our podcast website address is librarycast.podbean.com. We love hearing from our listeners, so please send us your comments and suggestions for future topics. Library Voices SC is the official podcast of the South Carolina State Library. Until next time, this is Curtis Rogers. Thank you for listening.